Welcome to the award-winning Dare to Dream podcast with Debbie Dashinger, covering metaphysics, ETs, shamanism, and channeling. Here you will find spiritual inspiration from today's thought leaders, along with cutting-edge insights from our interstellar brothers and sisters and ancient shamanic wisdom. Now, here's a new episode of Dare to Dream with your host, Debbie Dashinger.
Welcome to Dare to Dream. This is Debbie Dashinger, and today I'm speaking with Bob Frizzell, who's a master rebirther and teacher of over 30 years, whose books are regarded as spiritual classics. Through the Right Eye of Horus, around the circles and spirals of sacred geometry, in and out of the magic of breath alchemy, even surviving the potentially cataclysmic pole shifts intact, Bob says, we will eventually assemble internally our own Merkaba, the universal pattern of creation, and join the ascended masters. And we will also be basing our interview on one of his books. I don't know that I could recommend this book enough. One of the greatest reads, certainly for me. This is a keeper on my bookshelf. But this is the book we'll be talking a lot about. Nothing in this book is true, but it's exactly how things are, by Bob Frizzell. And Dare to Dream, this podcast radio show, has won 3 Talk Radio Positive Change Awards, the COVR Award for Best Podcast, Welp Magazine named Dare to Dream one of the top 20 best podcasts to listen to this year, and it's high ranking on Apple Podcasts. You can find this show on any of the popular and your favorite podcast or radio platforms. This show is sponsored by Dr. Dane here and Access Consciousness. They do energy work out into the world. If you'd like to attend their classes or become a facilitator, go to Dr. Dane here, HEER.com. If you would like to know your galactic ancestry and unlock your cosmic potential, you can get a free starseed report and video. You can explore various types of starseeds and start to uncover your galactic inception. Don't miss the chance to connect with your star lineage. Go to debbiedashinger.com/starseed and get your free gift. It's debbiedashinger.com/starseed. Also, I was just interviewed on Gaia TV for a second time with George Nori on Beyond Belief. I'd love you to catch the new episode where I talk about giant ant people living subterranean and a lot of history of indigenous people and their connection with extraterrestrials. It's a phenomenal conversation. And I've got a free gift for you there too. It is a free 7-day subscription trial, subscription to Gaia. Go to debbiedashinger.com, Gaia, debbiedashinger.com/GAIA. And just put my name in there, spell it correctly, and I will come up. And please, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this interview. I'm getting amazing feedback so far. And an upcoming event. This is our last piece of info before we get started. The upcoming event. I am facilitating an online despacho ceremony on April 9th. I'm a certified shamanic energy healer, Moon Ikki rites practitioner, and a despacho is a very sacred ceremony. It is a way powerfully to shift your life, to release what is no longer serving you, which, by the way, which is the entire theme of this 2025 year. So join the ceremony, shift your life, and start to create big miracles and new realities that you prefer. You need to register for the Zoom link and details. It's only $44. I guide you through the entire experience. Grab your seat. A lot of people are signing up and there are limited spaces. That's at debbied.net/despacho. All of these links, including Bob's links, are going to be in the show notes and descriptions. And again, for the despacho ceremony, it's debbied.net/despacho, DESPACHO. Well, my guest today, Bob Frizzell, is the founder of Breath Alchemy Technique. He's been a teacher of breathwork for more than 35 years. a senior student of Jim Leonard in Breathwork and Drunvalo Melchizedek in The Flower of Life. Bob is the author of several books, including Catching the Ascension Wave and, as I showed you, the 30th anniversary edition of Nothing in This Book Is True, But It's Exactly How Things Are. Bob is the founder of Breath Alchemy Technique. And if you'd like to learn more about him, go to bobfrizzell.com. It's FRISSELL.com. And with that, I welcome Bob Frizzell to Dare to Dream. It's so great to have you here.
Hey, Debbie. Good to be here. So glad to just be able to spend some time with you. It's awesome. So really looking forward to this.
Me too. I have to start with a comment I made to you before we began, because I'm an author also. I read books sometimes, I have to, for a living. Having so many people come on the show, I've been doing the show almost 18 years, and how did you put so many fascinating and deep pieces of detailed information into a book? How did you comprehend, even in your lifetime, and accumulate so much information on so many subjects at such interesting levels? And I mean that sincerely.
Wow, that's an amazing question. That's a great question. So let's see what I can come up with here. The first thing that comes to my mind, Debbie, is that this is the 30th anniversary edition of this book. So I've had 30 years to, you might say, sharpen my skills. But let's go back in the day to about 1990, late 80s, around 1990. What began to come to me, I had been a teacher of breathwork for some time then, so my intuitive skills were, connection to source, that sort of thing. And when I got inner messages, I always honored them. I always listened if they resonated with me. And one message that resonated with me very deeply back in that time was, "Hey, buddy, there's missing information and you need to be aware of it." Now, I knew that it made no difference that I had absolutely no idea what the missing information was, because I knew I had the entrance requirement. And that was the total 100% commitment to dig and do whatever it takes to find whatever it is that I'm missing. And it's so amazing how that happens when you're tuned in. People just started appearing out of the woodwork, out of nowhere. And I may only have a 5-minute encounter with certain individuals, but in that 5 minutes, I was given exactly what I need to continue my journey. So to cut a bit more to the quick, it was, I believe, in January of 1991, when I was giving a week-long breathwork training up in a local center in the mountains in California. And just prior to the evening seminar, I went down to the lunchroom, I don't know, to grab a snack, I guess. And I came across a stack of literature that just looking at it, it just started blowing my mind. I only had about maybe 5 minutes at most to look through this, but what I was looking at was truly a mind blower. And I'm going, wow, maybe this is the missing information I'm looking for. But again, I had to put that aside and get back and lead the evening seminar. But after the seminar was over, the guy who put that information out there was standing outside the door, literally just as though he was waiting for me. And we hadn't met yet, but there he was. And so we spent, I don't know, at least 2 or 3 hours that evening. I just asked him detailed information, and he so willingly shared it all with me. It was such an amazing experience that after its conclusion, well, it didn't really conclude, because he gave me some books to read, and I stayed up virtually the entire night looking at them. And then he said, "Well, I've got some videos. You want to spend tomorrow watching videos?" So we spent the whole day watching videos. And I'll tell you, Debbie, I came home so loaded with new information that I just... wow. It was just, is this what I was looking for? Well, I'm going to, at least it's a really good start. And so I just continued to dive into it. And then perhaps the best thing that happened out of that is that I connected with a like-minded group in the San Francisco Bay Area here. Bay Area is a big place. It's 50 miles or more from one end to the other. So there was a lot of people to connect with. And we did. And we would hold monthly meetings and just get together and share like information, you know, the quote-unquote conspiracy theory stuff, which we knew was not conspiracy theory because we had dug a little bit deeper than that. So out of that, one day I got a letter in the mail telling me of a workshop that was going to be given. This was in June of 1992. And furthermore, it wasn't even a live workshop. It was a workshop on video. And it said it was going to be 25 hours. And we'd really like you to attend. And the little promo that was on that letter absolutely convinced me. It talked about an immortal master, an ascended master by the name of Thoth, a guy who, according to that piece of literature, had been alive and in a body for 52,000 years. If that's true, you could say he's been around the block a few times. Maybe he's garnered some knowledge. And on top of that, it talked about ascension into the next vibratory rate, and which we would call the higher overtones of the fourth dimension, and how, if you know, probably not everybody's going to go, and so if you want to go, you better be prepared, and this workshop might just help in that preparation. So I go, yes, absolutely, I'm going to be there. Turned out to be 32 hours, and this was my introduction to the Flower of Life workshop by this guy named Drunvalo Melchizedek. Now, I'm sitting in the very back of a long rectangular conference room looking at a little 21-inch screen many feet in front of me. The screen was so small I couldn't see the guy, but what I could hear was rather amazing. And I remember sneaking up the side aisles just to get a glimpse of, who is this guy? What does he look like? Is this a name like that? Is this a real person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Well, long story short, I was so impressed with what I heard. I found out how to purchase the videos. And when I got those videos, I just shut everything down. Phone is off the hook. TV, forget that. Anything else. It was my source of entertainment because I was totally committed. My commitment was, I want to know what this guy knows. Yes. And I wasn't willing to stop until I felt that I had gotten there. And I was helped along. When you're on purpose, like I tell you, things just happen. Magic just happens. And then I found out that this guy Drunvalo was available for phone conversations. You could call him up on Saturday afternoons. So I started calling him every Saturday. And without question, he saw and heard my level of commitment and the questions I was asking and how they helped further the action for me. And then one day he said, you know, look, I'm getting tired of giving this Flower of Life workshop. I want to train someone to give it for me. Would you be interested? You bet I would. So I went to Austin, Texas, and spent 9 days and got trained by him. And I started giving the Flower of Life workshop really all over the planet. And it just went from there. And to cut even more to the present time, all that was intermingled with my breath alchemy teachings. And putting the two together, I felt that that I had really latched on to something, to what I was looking for. So going back to that evening at the evening up giving the seminar up in the mountains, that was great information, but what I began to realize, that's only the beginning. And all that was warm-up for the main event. And the main event came out of my doing my very best to master the content of those videos. And it also helped me understand experientially everything, including my breath work. Everything just, wow, it just took on a new level.
Are you still doing these? Are you still offering workshops or breathwork workshops or these combination, this marriage of this material workshops?
Well, what I do, I'm not traveling around the planet anymore. I got kind of tired. I understood what Drunvalo meant when he said he was getting tired of it. You travel around the planet for 20 plus years, and time to move on. So what I did is I put the Flower of Life workshop on video. Anybody who wants to get the workshop, all they got to do is go to my website and they can get the video. It's all there. And then I give breath alchemy sessions online my sessions I give on Skype, and there, well, I've got clients all over the planet, and so I'm doing exactly what I want to be doing. I just love the work I'm doing, the transformation quality of the breath alchemy, and the bottom line is the degree to which people appreciate it, and they do. So I appreciate it, and appreciate them in turn. And life is good. Life is good when you're on a roll, and I'm on a good one.
What a great story. That is amazing. I resonate so much with you, Bob. I am the same way. And I know, because I have a lot of friends and colleagues who say, it's amazing that you are like you are. I'm a researcher. I'm an aggregator. I'm a journalist. And a million things can pass me by and there's not even a blip. But then there'll be something. Right now, it's Nikola Tesla. And I'm like, boo, hugely deep diving for a million reasons into his life. But, you know, that's what it is for me as well. And I understand. And then the synchronicity of things coming. Yeah. So I want to start getting into so many beautiful pieces of this book. We'll never be able to cover it all, but I will get to as much as I can. One of the things that excited me, because I just shared this with George Noory on Gaia TV. Ah, you were talking about the Dogons, about the tribe from Africa. They were from West Mali, Africa, and their astonishing knowledge of Sirius B. So I want to explain to the audience, like, who cares? That's a planet. So how did they know this? So this is an indigenous tribe, just for edification. It was impossible in 3200 BC for the Dogon, who are considered remote and primitive, how could they have known about an invisible to the naked eye planet when, in fact, the telescope to see the planet was not invented till 1862, and the planet was not discovered till the 1900s. So tell us about that, this indigenous tribe and their relationship to the extraterrestrials.
Yeah, well, first of all, Debbie, the Sirius A and B, they are suns. They're not. It's not a planet. And so, what the Dogons were discovered, and again, we'll have to get to how could they possibly know that, is that Sirius is a binary star system, like most, if not all, star systems out there, actually, including our own. We might get to that, or maybe not. But anyway, what so the Dogons have all this information that they simply cannot have. They said there's another star out there. It's a white dwarf, and it's made, I think they said it's made of the heaviest matter in the universe, and that it circles around, orbits around Sirius, the star that we see, once every 50 years. Well, it turns out to be, it was extremely accurate because it's 50.1 years. And so they knew all this and other details about the Sirius star system. What they said when a team of scientists finally got brave enough to go and check it out and ask them, how do you guys know this? What they said was, okay, well, this ship came out of the sky. It landed, and out of the ship came some very dolphin-looking creatures. They were dolphins, by the way. They dug a hole. They filled it with water. They got in it, started swimming around, came up to the shore, and started telling us who they were and where they were from. They said, well, we're from Sirius. And then they gave them the details on Sirius A and Sirius B. And as you say, we didn't even know that there was a Sirius B. The Sirius B is the discovered star. Sirius A is now the one that the brightest star in the night sky. So we didn't even, as you said, know that there was a Sirius B until the 1860s when it was first seen, first discovered on the telescopes. You can imagine that the people who went, the scientists who went to interview these Dogons, had perhaps just a little bit of trouble trying to assimilate what they were being told, because it absolutely does not compute with reality as they know it. But then, you know, talking about my book, much of what we say in my book does not compute with reality as we know it. So it's right in my wheelhouse as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, that's an amazing story. And there is a book that was written by Robert Temple. It's called The Sirius Mystery. And that's really where I got most of this information on the Dogons.
Very interesting. Yeah. So basically, they're described by the Dogons as amphibious beings. I'm just going to fill a little for the transition in here with what Bob is sharing. And when the scientists ask the Dogons, like, how is this possible? How would you know this? They say these amphibious beings came, these dolphin-like beings came, and not only did they tell them about the planets, but they taught them agriculture. They taught them about civilization. They taught them about astronomy. They even taught them about the Earth. It's incredible. And, you know, they held relationship. And so, Bob, are there other indigenous tribes that you've researched that likewise have advanced or inexplicable cosmic knowledge that they say was gleaned from extraterrestrials?
Well, you know, if you look at history as we are told that it all began at about 38 BC in Sumer.
Sumeria,
yeah. Excuse me, I had to cough there for a moment. I hope I muted myself. And before that, there was nothing but hairy barbarians. But in my book, I have a chapter called Earth History, and in it, not only do I spill the beans on the Dogons, but also get into some details about, you know, just take a look at some of the details about what's going on in the Giza Plateau, the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx. It's a feat of engineering that we cannot duplicate today. And the Japanese tried. They tried in modern times to create a great pyramid that I think was one-fifth the size of the Giza, one at Giza. And using modern-day technology, they couldn't do it. And so how did these so-called primitive people carry 200-plus ton blocks throughout the desert, raise them up to 450 feet high, and do it with a level of precision that there is simply no way that we can match today? That great pyramid is precise, I would say, down to a single atom. So just try that on for size and ask the question, well, was it hairy barbarians who did this? And then you take a look at the Sphinx. And if you look at the Sphinx, this ascended master, this guy named Thoth, he doesn't even know how old it is. He said, and this to me is very interesting, he said that even though there's, I don't know, I think it's, he said 50 million years of history of Earth history, we can only go back about 5.5 million years. He said there was a break in the Akashic records then, and we can't access the earlier records. I don't know how that's possible, but anyway, that's what he said. And he can't find out in that 5.5 million years who the heck did build the Sphinx. So how long has it been here? Perhaps for millions of years. What we know for sure is that there are some people who got on the job. John Anthony West is the latest one. That was in the 1970s. He brought in an American geologist by the name of Robert Schock to take a detailed look at the wear patterns at the back of the Sphinx, which is up to 12 feet deep at certain places, and it sure looks a whole lot. There was a guy by the name of Schwaller de Lubitz who wrote a book in the early 1960s who first pointed out that these wear patterns look a whole lot more like they've been worn by water than they do by wind. But you have to stop and ask yourself, well, wait a minute. How could it be water when the Giza Plateau, the desert there, is perhaps 8,000, maybe 10,000 years old at the most? And before that, there was nothing but hairy barbarians, so they couldn't have possibly built the Sphinx. Well, Robert Schock came in and solved the mystery. And geologically speaking, he said there is no doubt about it. These wear patterns were caused by water erosion. Then it was calculated that in order for that to be true, the minimum amount of rain would have had to been torrential, nonstop rain pour for at least 1,000 years, which is unlikely. But that's all you need, because that pushes it back behind the 8,000 to 10,000 mark, way beyond, you know, 3,800 BC. And before that, there was nothing but hairy barbarians. So it's got to reopen the question. Egyptologists don't want to go there, but you know, if you're a scholar, you're certainly going to take a serious look at that. Now we can go on and on and on with that. I mentioned if you go to Lebanon, there's a place called Baalbek, where 800-ton blocks had to be moved at least a third of a mile and then raised up significantly in order to be put properly in place. And again, everything is just perfectly proper, perfectly done. Who did that? And when was that done? You can just go on and on with this. And I ask a few more similar questions to that. You've just got to open up the door that what we told have been told and what have been told that this is history. This is the way it is. 3800 BC is when it be. Oh, I don't think so. And so we have to reopen the whole thing, and in so doing, we begin to discover that there were advanced civilizations, probably super advanced civilizations, well before us, many of whom, perhaps all of whom, were not only seeded by ETs, but probably got significant amounts of help in this whole issue of how do you move 200-ton blocks through the desert and create something as incredible as the Great Pyramid, et cetera, et cetera. So I spent a great deal of time in the book just taking a deep dive into that and taking as detailed a look as I was able to into what was going on back in the day in Lemuria and then in Atlantis, for the very simple reason, Debbie, that if you want to know what's going on today, and if you want to know what will be going on in the future, how are you going to know unless you've known our past? And if you know our false past, there's no way you're going to get there. You're just going to keep recreating more and more. Well, basic false truths, let's put it that way. And so I felt it was very important to do my best to get down to the bottom line. I'm sure I don't have the final word on it, but it's certainly been digging deeply enough to get many of my readers absolutely excited and engaged, which I love. That's why I write books, and I write books because I absolutely am enthralled by the material myself. If I didn't love it, I wouldn't go there. So it's got to absolutely capture my imagination and my interest. And because it does, I find out that there's a lot of people, a lot of like-minded people out there who very willingly took a look at the open question and to begin the engaging of the possibility, not only of Lemuria and Atlantis, but what was going on before that. And it's a rather amazing history here
Well,
on
let me
planet
ask
Earth.
you this. I'm gonna do a shift here to the Philadelphia experiment and the multi, well, we'll call it dimensional manipulation. So the Philadelphia experiment attempts to make a battleship invisible, but talk about something gone wrong. It results in time and dimensional anomalies. Tell us what happened with this experiment. And then I have some follow-up questions for you.
Well, the Philadelphia experiment happened on August 12th of 1943, and what it was is the technology for that came from the Greys. And the Greys are another one of the ET races who have been here for some time. What we've heard and what I wrote about them in my book, I mainly just covered the negative side, how they were here to abduct us and how they can't be trusted. Yeah, there is a dark side to the Greys, but there's also another side that I covered extensively in Catching the Ascension Wave. So you put the two together, and the Greys had a definite purpose for being here. One of the reasons is that there were problems here on the planet Earth that was impacting them too. So they were here with permission to try to give the technology to see if they could get in to the problem and correct the problem. Well, in order to do that, what the basic technology was the counter-rotating fields of a Merkaba. And if you get the counter-rotating fields rotating at the right speed, first of all, up to 9/10 the speed of light, and then ultimately through the speed of light, and if you're tuned to a different wavelength universe, you will disappear from this reality, and you will reappear in whatever dimensional universe that you've tuned to, and you'd be just as real there as you would be here. Well, okay. So that was their purpose. And in just a moment, I'll get to what happened. But before I do, I wanted to say that, well, we were also in the height of World War II at the time. And so our purpose was to make a battleship invisible to radar so that we couldn't be plunked off so quite so easily by the German U-boats. And that made some degree of sense. And really, all you have to do is get the get your ship into one overtone higher than the wavelength universe we're sitting on right now, and you are invisible, at least to radar. So the thing is that in order to get the counter-rotating fields going, what you do is you rapidly, very rapidly, go through the colors of the rainbow. You know, the Roy G. Biv thing, Roy, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, all that stuff. Well, they got, according to the records, no further than the color green, and everybody freaked out on the crew. They didn't know what to expect. This is 1943. Come on. And so talk about freak out. Why would they freak out? Well, I'll tell you why. The ship disappeared. It was gone for about 4 hours out of the Philadelphia harbor, and it was bouncing around all over the place. They were interdimensionally crashing. When they came back 4 hours later, some of the crew members were half embedded into the steel bulkheads. Some of them were on fire. Some of them were disappearing in rapid measure, and they were all completely nuts. So that's why they all freaked out. Now, there were two crew members by the name of Duncan, Edward and Cameron Duncan, who were, you might say, manning the controls beneath the deck. And in so doing, they evidently were shielded from the main disaster happening on the deck. And they are the ones who shut the motors off, who tried to shut the motors off when it got totally out of control. But that's roughly the equivalent of taking a jetliner a couple hundred feet off the ground and then turning off the motors and then wondering why you crash. That's what they did. They crash landed, interdimensionally crashing. And to cut to the end, the whole thing was a disaster. It was not a successful experiment, to say the least. In fact, it probably only made the problem worse. Subsequently, I'm told it was it. I would say not completely resolved, but it's functioning more, shall we say, more smoothly today than it was back in 1943. There's a lot more to that story, but
Do you think the catastrophic side effects were accidental, or were they perhaps part of a deliberate gray agenda?
No, I don't think I think it was accidental. The Greys, I'm sure, had a vested interest in the success of the experiment, but it was not successful. So here again, they were here with complete permission to try and do it, you know, to try and see us through this thing. It just didn't work. But about 50 years later, they were able to pretty much patch things up. That was in 1993.
And then the Montauk Project,
yeah,
this also created a time loop. Yes.
Yeah.
1943, 1983. Do you think that these experiments permanently altered our timeline or fragmented reality?
Yeah. Well, now we're getting into a reality that's almost beyond our ability to imagine. But you asked me if I believe it did alter. Yeah, I think it did. What the 1983 Montauk Project was about was that, according to Al Bielek, who claims to be Edward Cameron, and let's go back to Duncan and Edward Cameron on August 12, 1943, jumping off the USS Eldridge, which is exactly what they did when the thing went totally out of control. They thought if they could jump off, they'd land in the water, they could swim back to shore, and everything would be fine. Well, they jumped off all right. But they did not land on water. They landed on dry land on Montauk, Long Island, not 1943, but 1983. And they were furthermore greeted by the director of the project, the same guy, John Neumann, who was the director of the Philadelphia experiment in 1943. So 40 years later, they meet in Montauk, the same guy again. So what's going on here? Well, Al Bielek, who claims to be Edward Cameron, and I don't want to get into that story. We'll just have to accept that or not for the moment. Al Bailey, also known as Edward Cameron, says that there are certain biorhythms, and I've had this confirmed from other sources too. He said they peak every 20 years, 1943, 63, 83, 2003, et cetera, et cetera. And that what that does is it opens up a time-space window that allows time travel to become far easier, far more feasible. And that, according to Al Bailey, i.e. Edward Cameron, is how Edward Cameron and his brother Duncan landed in Montauk in 1983. When they got to Montauk, they were told by von Neumann that, hey, this thing, what it's done is it opened up a time warp in space that's 40 miles wide. The thing is totally out of control. We're not sure what's going to happen. It could devour the entire planet. You guys need to get back and do whatever you can to shut the motors off to calm this thing down again. And so they did. They went back to 1943, got the whole thing shut down, and at the conclusion of that, after seeing all the disaster on the, guys on fire and people disappearing and all that sort of unbelievable stuff going on, Duncan Cameron decided, for whatever reason, I don't want to deal with this. He jumped overboard again. And he landed again in 1983 and became Duncan Cameron, in 1983. Well, you've got Edward Cameron hanging out in 1943, and the whole thing just gets weirder and more offbeat from there. And if you really want to reference this, there's a book called The Montauk Project that really goes into the details on all of this. And so that's a pretty fascinating read in its own right.
Do you think that the governments today, Bob, are still conducting covert time travel or timeline manipulation experiments?
Oh, come on. They've got technology that you simply would not believe. You simply would not believe it. There is a two-tiered technology. There's the technology that that we know about. And, look at how we're working today. We're working online. That's a pretty darn good piece of technology right there. But it relative to what they've got, we're not even scratching the surface. Catching the Ascension Wave, I go into more detail on the secret space program, on the two-tier technology system that we have, and how it all began. I don't think we have time to really get into how it all began, but it really began in Nazi Germany. It's where it really began and continues to this day.
Yeah.
I came across numerous whistleblowers, and what is the guy? William Tompkins. Yeah, he was the best one. Oh, goodness sakes. That guy had so much to say. He was 93 in 2015 when he wrote a book called Selected by Extraterrestrials. And he talks about how going way back into World War II, how in his early 20s, he was the director of a group of spies. I think he said there were 23 of them who had successfully infiltrated the German space program, and they were able to bring back detailed information on just what was going on there. And so that's where it all began. It culminated in 1955 when the Germans, not ETs, but it was the Germans who were circling the Capitol. 1952 it was. That's pretty well documented. You can get videos of that, I'm sure, online. Here's this fleet of UFOs circling around the Capitol in 1952. We all thought it was ETs. No way. We find out later it was the Germans. And what they were doing was signaling our government to, hey, it's about time to join us to capitulate, or there will be consequences. So we think that that's not possible. The Germans lost the war. Germany was thoroughly devoured. Ha ha. Yes, they lost the ground war, but they won the space war. They were hanging out in Antarctica, and they had been given technology, not only brand new ships, but actually the exact how to build them. And so they had all of that. We, on the other hand, were struggling from trying to figure out the 1947 Roswell wreckage. We didn't exactly know how it all ticked. But they said, look, we'll help you, but you got to help us too. And so there was an alliance that I suppose in a perfect world, it would have been better had we not made it. But to cut to the quick, according to William Tompkins, and I'll use him as my primary source, he said, we've got technology you simply would not believe that we are able to go anywhere in this galaxy. And he went on to say, not only in this galaxy. So try that on for if our listeners can accept that there in fact is a two-tiered technology system, and that hidden behind the wraps is technology that you simply would not believe, beyond Star Trek, way beyond Star Trek. And my intuition and if it resonates with me, and this resonated deeply with me because it took me ever since 1990 till about 20, oh, goodness sakes, just when I was doing research for Catching the Ascension Wave to put all these pieces together. And I think I finally got them all together. And when I did, got them all, it just fit perfectly like the missing piece. Here's the puzzle. It's all together. So does it resonate with me? Absolutely. Does that mean I can prove it? Of course not. But nothing in my book is true anyways. But it is exactly how things are.
That. Beautiful. So let's shift to sacred geometry, because you said things I haven't heard before.
Yeah.
Sacred geometry, photons, nature of reality. So you describe sacred geometry, Bob, as the language of light. And as we all know who are alive today, there's tons of people speaking light language, right? A lot of people waking up to their galactic history. And you write that sacred geometry is the emblem of reality throughout the cosmos, sometimes called the language of light or the language of silence. Tell us, why is sacred geometry so important? And how can sacred geometry be used, and why should it be used?
Well, yeah, that's sacred geometry is a universal language. It's known everywhere throughout the cosmos, and you can use it to talk about absolutely anything. And if we really want to wake up and discover what's going on in this reality, we have to tune into the fact that we're living in a holographic universe. And so what do I mean by a holographic universe? Which I used sacred geometry in my books to show the exact nature of the holographic universe. That's why I'm using it, not to teach sacred geometry, but to show you how it absolutely underlines everything. So the holographic nature of the universe. Yeah, I kind of lost my train there for a moment. Glad I got it back. The holographic nature of the universe. We know that if you take a holographic image, you can cut it into four equal pieces. You can cut it into 4,000 equal pieces. No matter how many pieces you cut it into, if you shine a laser on any one of those pieces, what you're going to get is a smaller version of the whole. The universe is holographic. You and I are intimately connected to the one infinite creator out there. We are perfectly functioning holograms of the whole. And if we don't know that, then we tend to see ourselves as isolated individuals looking out at a reality that, and since we don't connect the dots to see wholeness, we see separation everywhere we look. We do not put the pieces together. And in so doing, we're missing the entire thing. We settle for ourselves as just human beings. And I make the point consistently in my books that we are not just human beings. You and I are spiritual beings having a human experience. Now, there's a huge difference. If you're a human being, you've lost your spirituality and you're somehow looking for it and trying to find it. But if you're a spiritual being, you've come here on purpose and you come here on a mission. And ultimately, your mission is to assist the planet in helping it to wake up, to create this critical mass so that it can, in fact, ascend into the higher dimensional levels, which is very much on the edge of doing. And it can only do that when you've lit your own inner light. And so igniting your own inner light is where it all begins, and taking a detailed look at sacred geometry and beginning to show your mind, your left brain, your logical side, which does not see wholeness, which does not connect the dots, which only sees separation. You've got to show it in the only way you can, and that's step by step using the only language it understands, and that's logic, that there's only one creation pattern. There's only one image moving through all of life, and that, in fact, is shown perfectly through sacred geometry. And so if we get back to the origin, the origin of this universe, there was the one spirit that was infinite, I don't know, just infinite intelligence, but it's kind of hard to put a label on that. So what it did was it created infinite awareness and infinite energy, and out of that, it created the first photon. Now, the first photon, everything is a fractal of that. Everything, that's really all there is. Everything else is a holographic image of that. And so there's really nothing out there. It's all an illusion. And there's only one way. There's only one way to convince your mind that does not believe in the intuitive, your intuitive side and inspiration and creativity and all of that stuff. So it's just like a bad marriage, you know. There's no communication. One person can be telling the perfect truth and the other person will not hear it because it does not fit to their image of how reality should be. But when the left brain sees it and is absolutely convinced, then and only then will it begin to communicate and begin to join and create wholeness. The corpus callosum will relax and open up the two sides. This relaxation occurs. It allows communication to occur. And now we can begin to get on with it and begin to discover experientially our true nature. So getting deeper into sacred geometry, it's actually pretty hard to, unless I gave you an actual, you know, webinar and showed you step by step the drawings, which I've done in my book. In Nothing This Book Is True, there's, I don't know, about 60 drawings. And I was so committed to learning this stuff that I took the time to do every single one of those drawings. And believe me, it was an adventure. Mm-hmm. It was time consuming. I made a lot of mistakes, but my goal was to get it absolutely perfect, not knowing that I was going to write a book. And that's the images that are in that book. I drew them all. That's where they all came from. And in so doing, I took a major step forward in convincing myself of the reality of the of life, so that you know, you might have a belief in unity, but until it's your experiential knowing, I mean, come on, you know, what a belief is only going to take you so far. It's a start, but you've got to know it. You've got to know it in every cell of your body, sacred geometry can be a powerful teacher.
Absolutely. 100%. You know, this is so interesting. You're talking about different forms of energy and manifesting and dimensions and all of that. And I had mentioned in the beginning, one of my curiosities, we'll call that not an obsession, but massive curiosities is Nikola Tesla. You've got some info in there about there. So I want to talk a little bit about free energy and suppressed technology. Nikola Tesla's free energy, I mean, it was really meant for the good of all people, that we should all freely have this, but it was suppressed by very powerful and rich industries. So do you believe, Bob, that Tesla had access to extraterrestrial knowledge?
Yeah.
Yes. Reverse engineered alien technology.
Well, exactly where he got it, I'm not sure. He, in fact, stated that for the record, though no one believed him. Yeah, Tesla, easily the most brilliant scientist we've ever had. Mm-hmm. My favorite quote from Tesla is, if you want to understand the universe, you got to think of it in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration. And so there we go. That guy was brilliant. Yeah, just as you say, he tried to give us free energy way back in the early 20th century. And J.P. Morgan says, well, I'll let you know. I guess they're still letting us know because it certainly hasn't been unearthed yet. But you got to realize that when they do give us free, it's inevitable. It is inevitable now. I go on in my book to briefly talk about the end machine, this guy named Bruce De Palma, who created the thing. Nobody believed him either. And sadly, he's not around anymore, but he was a true pioneer in the field. And there's a number of people who have proved that free energy is real. Tesla was just the first. The only problem is that accidents usually befall these people who try and put out their free energy thing. Why would that be? Well, if you're gonna bring out free energy, now you're also looking at anti-gravity. Now you're also looking at the UFOs, and now you're starting to look at the real secret space program that we have and what we've been doing behind our backs for, well, ever since the 1950s from now on. So that's a pretty big can of worms to open. And that's one of the big reasons why it hasn't been allowed to come out yet. But it is inevitable. It will. The times are changing. The veil is being lifted, and the darkness can no longer survive in the shadows because the light is stronger on the planet now. I make the point for the first time in 16,000 years, and that means that the laws have reversed themselves. What used to work to serve the darkness perfectly, to keep them in the shadows behind the scenes, now is only further exposing them. And so free energy in the unveiling of the secret space program is absolutely inevitable. When will it happen? I don't know. My prediction is within the next decade. But with that being said, there's just it's just I'm speechless. What more can I say
It's
about it?
so beautiful. You know, the Bermuda Triangle is described as being affected by unstable Merkaba fields. Now, this is super interesting to me because last year I spoke on a cruise to the Yucatan. The cruise ship left out of Florida, Port Canaveral, and to make its way to the Yucatan, we had to go through the Bermuda Triangle. And so I did a little bit of research because I thought, well, this is pretty fascinating information. And so you write that it's because of unstable Merkaba fields and this can cause disappearances. Do you think that there's other locations on Earth where these dimensional anomalies occur?
Yes, there are. At the time, further research has shown me that absolutely that is a, well, let's put it that a very real possibility. And if I get another book put together, I've got to put it in. There's at least a dozen other points on the planet that are very similar to the Bermuda Triangle. And what that means is that if you are fortunate, because it's not every day 24/7 that if you're in the Bermuda Triangle, you're going to disappear. But if you're in there at the time when the fields are activated, you're gone. And where did you go? Into a different dimensional level. And I hope you were prepared because if you're not, it's going to be the ride of your life and you may not survive it. But if you are, you're probably going to be okay. So with that being said, as I indicated earlier, my further research has shown me that there's very likely another dozen spots or so on the planet. And speaking of sacred geometry, they are all geometrically linked that do the same exact thing as the Bermuda Triangle. And so was it a function of an out of control Merkaba field at the floor of the ocean in what was Atlantis? Maybe, maybe not. I think it's more complex than that if there's more than one of them. And I'm still taking a look at that. But it is a real phenomenon. There's books that have been written on the Bermuda Triangle, and that's probably why as much info on it has come out. I'm sure they'd rather not we know about any of it. However, if you're on a cruiser and it suddenly just disappears, it's probably going to make the news. So I don't know how secret you can keep it. I'm glad you made it. But if you were there at the wrong time, you'd better. I hope you enjoy life in the new dimension. They appear to be interdimensional portals where if you know what you're doing and you know how to tune to it, and tuning to everything, tuning to different dimensional realities is a function of knowing how to change your conscious wavelength, to change your conscious wavelength, to tune to the new reality, to tune to the new dimensional world that you're about to enter into. And then if you know how to make a 90-degree turn, and you actually do it, you will disappear from this reality. You will appear in whatever new reality that you've tuned to, and you'll be just as real there as you are here. But with that being said, if these are really dimensional portals, then you can use them. They would be the equivalent of wormholes also. And, you know, I think that we've seen enough so-called science fiction movies, which really are probably not science fiction movies, to get a sense of what a wormhole is. It's the fast way of traveling from one dimensional world to another, of transversing many, many, who knows how many light years, probably in little or no time at all. And so you don't get into a rocket ship and try and do it that way. That's the tin can technology that is all we've been given so far. And as I said earlier, there's technology that is so far beyond what we know about that it will just I can just hardly wait to get the public's reaction when that begins to come out. That's going to be so exciting. Wow.
I agree 100%, hopefully in our lifetime. And so this is one of your many beautiful books, Bob. Where can people read your books? Where can they find you and work with you?
Well, you go to bobfrisell.com, and you've got the links up on, and thank you for, so people just click on the link. That'll take you there. You go there. I got a bunch of blog posts that I think will attract your attention. I'm also giving everybody an opportunity not only where to get my books. I guess Amazon is the easiest place, but it's not the only place. So I got links to where you can buy my books. But more than that, I'd like to talk to people. And like I said earlier, I think that was when we were on, I give online breath alchemy sessions, and I got clients from all over the planet, which I just absolutely love. It's so much fun, so exciting to have that. And so I start all potential new clients off, and anybody who just wants to talk to me, with a free 30-minute consultation. And I just love, I learn a whole lot by talking to people. And look, I'm not trying to sell you anything or convince you anything. I'm not trying to convince you that there's a secret space program. Nothing in my book is true anyway. So it's up to you to decide what's real and what's true. And if I'm real or if I'm not, if I'm just putting you on. So if you want to find out more about me, go to my website. And if you want to dig a little bit deeper, read my books, take a look at my blog post, and schedule some time to talk with me. I'd love to spend 30 minutes with you and see what happens from that.
Beautiful. What a great invitation. So Bob Frizzell, this is Dare to Dream. What are you next, Dare to Dream? What are your future dreams and goals? What are your future dreams, Bob?
Are we still on? We're off the air though, right?
No, we're very much live.
Oh, we're still on. Oh, I'm sorry.
This is all you, baby.
My future dreams are to just keep doing what I'm doing. You know, it's just like I'm going back to 1990, where it just came to me intuitively, very powerfully, very clear message. Hey, there's missing information that you need to be aware of. Well, that hasn't ended. And so for me, future dreams are, I mentioned the quote from Tesla. If you want to understand the nature of the universe, you think in energy, frequency, and vibration. And my favorite quote apart from that came from Helen Keller, where she said, life is either an exciting adventure or it's nothing. Well, I want to keep the flame burning as brightly as possible so that when I wake up in the morning, I got a smile on my face, because life for me is an exciting adventure. Mm-hmm. And I've got clients to see. I've got people to talk to. I've got stuff to research for my next book. And it just keeps me going. And it keeps me lit from within. The flame is burning brightly. Life is an exciting adventure. And I'm doing my best, absolutely doing my best, to help to create the critical mass so that the planet Mother Earth can become lit from within, and in so doing, create the necessary critical mass to ascend into the next dimensional level. Because when we get there, we are told by one of the documents that I've researched deeply, it's called the Law of One, that when we get to the fourth dimension, or fourth density, as they call it, that we're going to be entering into a world that is at least 100 times more harmonious in every single way than even our very best moments here on third dimensional Earth. So if you can just take a moment and imagine, what would your life be like if you were 100 times more joyful than even your best moments, 100 times more creative, 100 times more inspired, 100 times more, you just go on and on down the list. What would your, would that be worth shooting for? I kind of feel like it is. And so that's where I'm at. And that's why I'm out there doing whatever I can to just help bring us along, to create the critical mass so that we can get to the next level. And in the interim, create a golden age here on planet Earth, where the nature of reality will finally be revealed to us. The free energy, the interdimensional travel, and all of that stuff will just become commonplace, will become our norm. And that will absolutely prepare us for entrance into the next dimensional reality. So life is an exciting adventure. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Period. End of statement.
Wow. Beautiful, beautifully said. I end today's show with this quote from Bob Frisell. The breath holds great power. It is the quickest way to return from material to the immaterial world, to the place that the field exists, to the supernatural or spiritual realm. Subscribe to this number one transformation conversation, Dare to Dream, with Debbie Dashinger. Leave a comment and share. It's important. And thank you. On the next weeks on this program, tune in, because Tyler Ellison will be here. He channels the Sasani beings. And after that on this program will be Barbara Hand Clow. They are sure to be amazing conversations. Thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Thanks for joining us this week on Dare to Dream. Make sure to visit our website, debbiedashinger.com. That's DEBBIDACHINGER. You can subscribe to the show on YouTube and all major podcast sites, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this program, we'd appreciate a like and comment, or tell a friend about the podcast. That will help us out as well. And if you like this conversation, you might want to check out Debbie's shamanic healing programs. And Debbie is available for coaching to write your book, and her company takes your finished book to guaranteed international bestseller. Be sure to subscribe for our next episode of Dare to Dream podcast with Debbie Dashinger, your number one transformation conversation.